Truth for Today Bible class. And this is the first day of September, 1981. Well, our subject for the first part of the session is back in Isaiah. We got down to chapter 7, 5th verse last time. This is a little bit hard for get in mind, but if you get the actors in the scene, it's particularly in the first part, is written during the time of King Ahaz. He was a king of Judah. That's down around Jerusalem, Judah and Benjamin. And there's Ephraim, or Israel, sometimes called Ephraim. And the king there was Pekah, P-E-K-A-H, Pekah. And their enemy is, well, we might say there's an enemy of both of them, but there's a little getting together here. Assyria. Now on the map here, you'll find that the lower part down there on the map is Judah, and then the upper part there is Israel. And up in the yellow part above and over to the right a little bit is Syria. Over on the edge of the sea over there to the left in that yellow is Phoenicia. And you notice up in there, a little way up into Syria, there is the name of Golan. And of course, you've been hearing a great deal about Golan lately. Just give you a little idea. Now, there's another one that comes in, and he's kind of an enemy of the whole bunch. And that's way over in Assyria. That'd be way over here on the map, over to the right, over near Babylon. And that is King Sennacherib. Now, those are the main actors. Now, we have here Syria and Israel, or Ephraim, we call it, joining hands to fight against Judah. With the idea of putting the king of Syria on the throne of David in Jerusalem. Well, that's the plot. And so if we get that in mind, now when we start to chapter 7, we kind of take a little brief review of it. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that the king of Syria and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. So this is the picture I've given you. And we had this last week, and we want to be sure to get the thing in mind. And it told the house of David, now that'd be Judah, saying that Syria is a confederate of Ephraim. Now to think a part of their kingdom of Israel would go and join up with a country like Syria, that is almost unthinkable. And his heart, that is the king, was moved in the heart of his people as the trees of wood are moved to the wind. They really felt that pretty badly. Then said the Lord unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Shear-Jashub, thy son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway out of the fuller's field. Now, Shear-Jashub, in your margin here, says, the remnant shall return. That's the meaning of it. That's prophetic. Now, this is a Judah. The remnant shall return. Then say that of Israel, or Ephraim. And say unto him, take heed and be quiet. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted, for the two tails of those smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger resin of Syrian of the son of Remaliah, or Remaliah, call those two firebrands in Israel and Syria. Because Syria, Ephraim, or Israel, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us. I just tear it to pieces, get a place in it, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. And Tabeel was the father of this Rezin we've been talking about, who's the king of Syria. Well, this isn't going to work. Even Israel forgets at times that there is one who rules the heavens and makes and unmakes kings and gives kingdoms to whom he will, as Nebuchadnezzar had to learn. And so here, all of these plottings and everything that's going on, why, it can't go on. It can't go on unless the Lord allows it. And so in verse 7, it says, the Lord God, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. It won't work. For the head of Syria is Damascus. All right, now you know where the capital of Syria is. I think that's on the map there somewhere. And the head of Damascus is Rezin. Of course, he's a king, as we said. And within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people, Israel. All right. 65 years, that's 65 years. And if you look up your years and add them up and so on, and you have it in your margin here that Ahaz has 14 years yet, and Hezekiah 29, and Manasseh 22, making 65 years, and as fulfilled in 567 B.C. Israel was taken and captive and taken out of the land. Now you see, you get into prophecies, so often we have definite numbers like this given. And if we'll take and make a big broad outline or a line for a base point, then fill in these places that we have where we have a definite number of years and we can figure that where it starts and so on, we can get a pretty good picture of the Old Testament history in a little while and just about fix where all of the years are. In fact, it's pretty accurate. And that's an interesting thing. Of course, now it's all worked out for you. In the back of your companion Bible, you have Appendix 50 there, and then you have after it the main events of the Old Testament, and you can look down through that, but then it's a little fun sometimes to put it down yourself and remember it better. Well, head of Syria is Damascus. Head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken, and it be not a people. In other words, they'll just be so dispersed and scattered among the Assyrians that they will practically lose their identity. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria. That's where they had their capital at that time, Israel. And the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son, which we just said here was Pekah. And if you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Now, the words in the Hebrew on that are words that sound a little bit alike, and it could be put it this way, if you put it in English, if you will not trust, ye shall not be trusted, or no belief, no relief, or will not understand, shall not surely stand, or confiding, no abiding, no confiding, no abiding. So there are some English ways of expressing it as to how the rhythm and how the words be used in the Hebrew. And so Isaiah is told just how these things are going to be. Moreover, the Lord spake again unto Ahaz, saying, now we get Ahaz here, get him straight now. You remember I told you he was king of Judah. He hasn't been walking straight like he should, being the king of Judah and the Jerusalem. Saying, ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. He's invited to ask for a sign. You better have heeded that. Now, quite a number of years later, we find that a sign is asked for, and the sign is given. But here he says, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. It has his mind already made up. And there's even no doubt that he'd even sent messengers in to Syria to help him out in this thing that he was wanting to do. Well, it looks like all three of them are in the wrong. Ahaz of Judah won't listen to the Lord. And Ephraim is going to join up with Syria, and Syria certainly is a godless nation. You take a look at the three of them, and you wouldn't think that one was any better than the other. But we do have the little promise in here that Judah, a remnant, should return. And he said, "Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you weary my God also?" Well, I was just looking over this afternoon how the Israelites tempted the Lord 10 times after they left Egypt before they got into the land. And here we are in after judges and kings and so on down the line, and they aren't any better. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. You don't ask for one, you won't have one, but the Lord will give you a sign. Behold, a damsel shall conceive and bear a son, shall call his name, and shall call, that is, she will call his name Emmanuel. Remember, I said damsel, that is the best translation of that. Now, that's going to get into a big tizzy here to argument on this, because in the Old Testament it is Bethula. And it could mean a young woman, married or unmarried. But when it does receive its fullest fulfillment in the New Testament, and you get into the Greek, it is a virgin, and no other possibility. Now here is something that's fulfilled at the time, and then will be fulfilled, fullest fulfillment, later. A lot of prophecies are like that, a first and a secondary fulfillment. Now, we don't know who this young woman is. We can only guess. Some think it was the king's daughter. And maybe it was Isaiah's wife. I don't know. And we'll see a little bit later about that possibility. I rather think not, but then my opinion doesn't amount to anything. And I haven't anything solid to base it upon. That is, I haven't discovered anything yet, and I haven't found anybody else that has. Well, here's what this child, Emmanuel, God with us, it says, butter and honey shall ye eat. Or maybe instead of butter is better curds. That he may to refuse the evil and choose the good. Maybe that'd be a good diet for that sort of thing. I don't know. Well, your note says that he may know means up to the time of his knowing. That is, the prophecy shall come to pass while still a babe. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, a land thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. And that came about 2 years later. So the tile must have been pretty small. And the Lord shall bring upon thee, and upon thy people, and upon thy father's house, days that have not come. That is, they haven't had days like that. Sounds a little bit like the last part of Daniel's prophecy, where he speaks about that there's a time coming upon Israel, and there'll be a great tribulation and so on, and nothing ever been like it, or nothing would be. And so here is going to be trouble. From the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. Now let's see here. The Lord shall bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. That's the days that's going to come. You have to put two and two together, see? But that is what's going to happen. The king of Assyria will come. Sennacherib. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall hiss for the fly that is in the uttermost part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. Now, we've had that word hiss used in here before. And Note said it was a way that the beekeeper could call his the bees into the hive from out in fields and so on. He had a signal, like something like hissing or something like that, probably like calling hogs or sheep or something. And he says they will call them from Egypt and from the land of Assyria, way over the Tigris-Euphrates River, almost the mouth of them. And they shall come and shall rest, all of them, in the desolate valleys, and in the holes of the rocks, and upon all thorns, and upon all bushes or pastures. In other words, when these folks come, this land is going to be desolate. You can see it pictured here. It won't be tilled. In the same day shall the Lord shave with a razor that is hired. Now, sometimes we have these figurative speeches and so on. Now, their land is going to be shaved with a razor, figuratively. And the razor is namely by them beyond the river. Oh, hired. A razor is hired, namely by them beyond the river, by the king of Assyria, the head and hair of the feet. And it shall also consume the beard. Ahaz will hire. Now you're getting this story put together. He's going to go to Assyria to get help against Ephraim and Syria, his near neighbors. Way over and get Assyria to come. And it shall come to pass in that day that a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep. Now, just on the surface there, that doesn't mean a thing, does it, really? Well, it does mean a lot. Where are the grapes of Eshcol? Where are all of the olive trees and the wine presses? See? The land will be so desolate that at that time, a man will have probably a young cow and a couple of sheep, and that's all he'll have. No crops. And it shall come to pass, for the abundance of milk that they shall give, he shall eat butter, where curds may begin. For butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land. And of course the honey you can gather out of the rocks, the wild honey, there's plenty of it. I don't think they kept hives in like they do now, there's no record of it at least. They hadn't domesticated the bee yet at that time, probably. See, when we have two insects now that are domesticated, that's what they tell us, and that is the bee and the silkworm. That's an insect in its adult state. Man has domesticated those two insects. Not very much for all of the thousands or millions of them there are. And so that's about all they have left to eat, is some milk or curds. You don't keep milk very long in that land. You've got to use it right away after you milk the animal, because in that climate it doesn't keep very long. But if you let it sour to make curds or cheese out of it, why, of course, that'll keep quite a while. And it shall come to pass in that day. You see, they're talking about that day all the time. That every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings, it shall be even for briars and thorns. Now you can see why I was saying it would be desolate and so on. For at one time, there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silver pieces rent. It should be for briars and thorns. Now, I suspect that in that land, if the land wasn't tilled and wasn't taken care of, the briars and thorns would take over pretty fast. Unfortunately, I have one of those places where that sort of thing happens too. And if you don't do something and go out and keep clearing things off, the first thing you know, you got a lot of thorn bushes and thistles and these multiflora roses springing up in the fields. They're an awful nuisance. So I can understand a little bit, maybe what these folks are up against. If I leave this place of mine go for a few years, it'd just become a wilderness. Bushes and trees starting up and so on. Well, I might just add in that, along personal experience, and you don't mind that maybe, that about 2 miles from here, where my old home was, that was a natural prairie. And so the home that my folks had was probably one of the very first in this part of the country that was settled, because they didn't have to cut down trees. And we didn't have the thorns growing on that ground and growing up and so on, excepting possibly wild cherry trees along the fence rows. But a difference, but in 2 miles, a great deal of difference in the ground. And this ground over in Israel, it could really raise thorns and thistles and so on too. And so people, the Israelites, had to keep rubbing out in their fields to keep these things out, and the vineyards especially. And I think we spoke about it. In the vineyards, there'd be those wild grapes growing up, and there were many of them poisonous and so on. They had to keep rooting those things out. And on all hills that shall be digged with the mattock, there shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns. In other words, they keep digging it up, and they use a mattock at that time for digging, I don't have one. It's just exactly a mattock. I have an instrument here, an old one that is very much like it. It's called an Indian hoe. But, you have a piece of iron on the end of a handle and fixed a little bit like an ordinary hoe, except it's heavier metal and not quite so wide. Oh, not more than 3 inches. So I'm a little bit less than that. Probably a mattock, if you know what a pick is, a little bit like, except the bit on the pick is very narrow. And so, if they keep cultivating the ground, why then the thorns and the briars don't grow. But it shall be for the sending forth of oxen, and for the treading of lesser cattle. In other words, they won't be raising grapes and so on, but they can have the grounds cultivated enough that they can have pasture. Well, now that is telling a little bit about the prophecy and so on there. Takes us up to chapter 8. Moreover, the Lord said unto me, Isaiah speaking, of course, take thee a great roll and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. What a name. And it was a child of that name, a boy. And it is prophetic. And pathetic, too, you might say, as well as prophetic. Words sound a little like, don't they? Well, that name means that things are going to happen fast. You could say, I think it gives you the exact words down here in the note, but I just don't see it right now. Anyhow, that these things would come to pass pretty soon. Now, a great roll. Some have translated a tablet, because you wouldn't write on a roll, a scroll with a man's pen or some agricultural instrument. On the other hand, there are some who say that this is not a roll nor a tablet, but it's a mirror. It has to be of a good size. Now, if it were a mirror, it probably would be highly polished copper that the Israelites used. There were some that did use silver, some of the countries. It was highly polished. Used it for a mirror. And there have been some of those dug up, too, from back about that time. Little ones, about 3 to 4 inches, so the women carrying a purse. Those little mirrors. And this said, take a big one. And write on it this name. Maher Shealtiel Hashbaz. So that everybody could see. And I took unto me faithful witnesses to record. Here's the witnesses, Uriah the priest, and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. All right, there's the name, prophetically. And I went unto the prophetess, that's his wife, and she conceived and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name Maher Shealtiel Hashbaz. Now, so many times you find the prophets doing something like that to show the people. One was to go in sackcloth and ashes, and another was to cut off part of his beard and leave part of it on. And, there's a number of things you read through the prophecies that these prophets did to get the attention of the people and to speak to them. Now, if a man would go out into the public at that time with one half of his face shaved, and he wasn't supposed to even shave, the Israelites weren't, the other half not shaved, well, he's bound to get an audience. That's a way to get attention. So, you can see what's going on here. Isaiah has a message, and God wants him to get that message to the people, and he got to get their attention. Now, he couldn't take a 2x4 and bat him across the head like you do a mule in order to get his attention. Didn't do that. For before the child shall have knowledge, this is beginning to make you think of this up here you see in its other chapter in verses around the 15. And I went, then said the Lord to me, call his name, and then verse 4, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father, my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. Now get that. Israel and Syria will be destroyed by Assyria. And I wonder how much damage they'll do to Judah. Well, that comes in another story. Isaiah doesn't say very much about it. Not here, at least. And the Lord spoke unto me again, I'll get it right for a while, saying, forasmuch as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria in all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck. Now that's showing how thick the people would be and so on. It's the invasion and so on. So it's like if there was waters coming up to the neck. And stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel, Judah. So Judah is going to suffer from this invasion too, as well as Israel and Syria. Now, if you could just get the history of that, when that happened and so on, what happened, it's rather interesting. And so the picture is, and of course when he goes up over all his channels and go over his banks, the Tigris-Euphrates River, and especially Euphrates with all the dams and the lakes and irrigation channels and so on, and not only irrigation channels, but even shipping channels for boats. And at that time, Babylon was a wonderful world trade center, and they had the land so irrigated that they could just raise immense crops all around there in that valley around Babylon, as well as shipping coming in. And it's rather interesting to read this story of that, because after Semiramis, another queen took over, and she did a lot of great work for Babylon, including temples and public works and so on. And since there had been, up to her time, a direct access from the sea by boats right to Damascus, she contrived a defense plan. And she had big channels built and circled around and looping back and forth around the, did I say Damascus? I meant Babylon. Babylon. So they'd have to go over the thing about five times before they get to the city. Wonderful piece of work. A lot of that was still standing and still extant back in 1675 or a little earlier. A lot of that was still standing, and I have some writings here by an eyewitness who saw Babylon and described it how it was and so on. And he spoke even of how it had been at one time with the golden-leaved gates along the river, and how they were opened at night by, or they were left open by the guards at night, and the army of Cyrus, the Medo-Persian, came in and took it. Well, that's interesting, so on. He even describes the Tower of Babel. That wasn't all down yet either. And he could see yet enough of it left that he could tell something of the stories that it had and the circular roads that went around that they could get up to the top and so on. You'll find that in the history by Josephus, if you can find a copy anywhere in the library. Like I said, Josephus was born in 1602, and that is before the King James Version was written. Did I say Josephus? I'm getting my names mixed a little bit. I'm talking about, I'm going to say a name, Herodotus. Book's right here. Stuck fast. Going to get up, but I couldn't. Herodotus, and he's a very great historian, and he tells you quite a bit about things that happened way back to even as far as 600 B.C. Now, I was talking about Josephus. Josephus gives you some of the same thing, too, but he doesn't give it the detail like Herodotus does. Remember that Josephus was a Jewish historian, and he gives you a history of, practically all the Old Testament from Adam until the siege of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And he was living at that time, A.D. 70, and he was an eyewitness. And so you can get a lot of the details of the battle and the siege of Jerusalem by Titus, the Roman general, and what happened and so on. And you'll find it agrees very well with the description you have of it in the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy. Now I'll get back to my story here again. This is all a lot of sidelines and so on. I've even lost my place right now. Oh, yes. Verse 9. I was trying to keep a mark here and I didn't. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. And give ear, O you afar countries. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Repeating it. That's what's going to happen to these far countries if they start to go against God's people. They will be broken in pieces. But they may do a lot of damage to Israel too, because the Lord allows other nations to chastise his people when they need it. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. All of these countries is against Judah. It says, just take counsel together, but it'll all come to nothing. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. For God is with us, Isaiah says. Well, that's confidence evident. And he had been assured of that very thing when God spoke to him and gave him his prophecy. And here he goes on and says, for the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people. Say, oh, he's not to act and behave himself like the people he's prophesying to, the people he's living with. He's to live in a little higher plane of life than that. Say ye not a confederacy to all them for whom this people shall say a confederacy, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself. That is, give him high regard, put him in his place. And let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. Well, I guess that's pretty good instruction. That's really timely. And he shall be for a sanctuary, a place of safety, a place to flee to. But for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. For a gin or a trap and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. So there's going to be a great deal of suffering. But still there is the assurance that a remnant should return, that there would be the faithful ones would be safe. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I'll bind up the testimony, write it on a scroll and tie it up, seal it, and seal the law among my disciples. And I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob. Now, Jacob and Israel are used exactly in the right place. Now, when it speaks of Jacob, that's not perfection. That's not Israel, who is a prince of God. Jacob was the weak one. But he had his name changed to Israel when he finally prevailed in his wrestling with God. And so, I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel, from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. So he says that he is a prophet, and he has this word from the Lord, and he has children, and he has other signs and so on. For those who dwell in Mount Zion, that is Judah. He's not taking the part of Ephraim or Israel. And when they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto wizards that peep and that mutter. And they say unto you that his people advise you to do that. And have familiar spirits, that is, fortune tellers and wizards. Now, of course, a wizard is a man, a witch is a woman. Same meaning. That peep and mutter. Watch out for folks that peep and mutter. That talk in some language you can't understand. It isn't any language, but peeping and muttering. Should not a people seek unto their God? Shouldn't they? Instead of these wizards and other folks. You remember that King Saul went to one of those witches, the witch of Endor, to get information. You know that people, even today, will do most anything, pay almost any price to get somebody to tell them something about the future. And you have these astrologers and fortune tellers and so on scattered all over, even though it's against the law. I noticed in our local paper lately that they've been admitting advertising. That sort of thing. Well, a great deal of Satan. Of course, there are some who can fake this sort of thing and make good money at it. They happen to know their country and the people well enough and so on. They can, and at least they can give answers that are ambiguous, so whichever way things happen, why, it'll be true. They're good at that. Of course, they have to take a course and get into that sort of thing. There are some of them are real mediums, and they do have contact with spirits. There's no question about that. But he says, shouldn't people seek unto their God? For the living to the dead? That says in the note, should not my people seek unto its God? Or should the living look unto the dead? I think it's a better way of rendering it. Some of us left out there. These languages are like our own language. They have these ellipses where they leave words out and you have to fill it in. You see, Israel were always warned in their law to stay away from any of that fortune telling, any of that peeping and muttering, that sort of thing, because it's of the devil. And they were to stay away from that sort of thing. It even creeps into religion sometimes, you know. In fact, there are a lot of religions based on that sort of thing. If you have any doubts, just turn to the law and the testimony. The law and the testimony, that's your only truth. If they speak not according to this word, that is, God's word, it is because there's no light in them. Well, maybe I can about squeeze in the next two verses here. Time is about up. And they shall pass through it hardly, bestead and hungry. And it shall come to pass that when they shall be hungry, they shall fret themselves and curse their king and their God and look upward. And they shall look unto the earth for the whole trouble and darkness, dimness and anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness. Folks who will seek fortune tellers and all of that sort of thing, that's kind of an end to come to. I've seen enough of it in my own lifetime to know that it hasn't done anybody any good. And then some fearful things happen. So that ends that chapter 8 of Isaiah. We'll begin there our next time.